Welcome to Preaching Podcasts. For those who proclaim publicly, this is a weekly podcast from the Stevenson School of Ministry in the Diocese of Central Pennsylvania, where we take a look at the lectionary from diverse and unique perspectives to help prepare church leaders, preachers, teachers, pundits, proclaimers for Sunday worship. I am your host, Deirdre Good, and with me, as usual, is Althea Spencer-Miller and Josh Davis. Hello.
Hello.
Hello, everyone.
Good to be with you both again. We are on the second Sunday in Lent in the year 2021, and now we are establishing ourselves into the new liturgical season of Lent. We'll continue our readings. We jump from Mark 1 to Mark 8 in the Gospel. We've got a central focus of that Gospel. I'll just jump to that immediately. A central focus is the threefold teaching in Mark 8, 9, and 10, that the Son of Man, Jesus, is teaching that the child of humanity must undergo great suffering and be rejected by elders, and after 3 days rise again, rejected and killed, and after 3 days rise again. And this is spoken openly, and Peter begins to rebuke him. Peter is rebuked by Jesus in this central section of Mark's Gospel for, as Jesus says, setting your mind not on divine but on human things. And immediately Jesus turns to the crowd and the disciples and says, if anyone wants to follow, let them deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. So whoever wants to save their life will lose it, and whoever loses their life for my sake and for the sake of the gospel will save it. So that is the central teaching of Mark's gospel, and it's about undergoing suffering. It's about following Jesus in the way of the cross, which is, of course, really what the season of Lent is about. We've just come through Ash Wednesday when we're reminded of our mortal existence, dust to dust, ashes to ashes. The collect, going back to the beginning of the lectionary readings, is about a merciful and gracious God, gracious to all who have gone astray from God's ways. And the promise is in the collect that God will bring them again with penitent hearts to embrace and hold fast the unchangeable truth of your word through Jesus Christ, your Son, who is also the word. The reading from Genesis 17 is the Genesis covenant and the promise by God to Abraham that he will not only experience a name change from Abram to Abraham, but he will be the ancestor of a multitude of nations. And this promise that Abraham will be exceedingly fruitful is, of course, effectuated not just through the promise of God, but through the actions of Sarai. God says to Abraham, as for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. And I will bless her, and I will give you a son by her. And she shall give rise to nations, kings of people. So this is a promise of God's graciousness, God's fidelity, God's steadfastness in the covenant traditions of Genesis 17 here and also Genesis 15, where there's another Abrahamic covenant. Romans 4 talks about the promises to Abraham that Paul is working out in terms of its meaning for an unknown group of people to whom he writes the letter to the Romans. He's never gone to Rome and preached there at all. So Romans introduces Paul's theology for, shall we say, God-fearers, Jews, Gentiles, whoever is gathered in Rome to hear the reading of this letter to the Romans, probably by Phoebe, who is first mentioned in Romans 16, where people in Rome are identified as recipients and tradents and readers of the letter. Paul expounds the notion that the promise to Abraham doesn't come through the law, but through righteousness of faith. And for this reason, it depends on pistis, on faith. So Abraham can be called the father of many nations, as Genesis 17 makes clear, and God can call into life the dead and things that do not exist, but it's established also through Abraham's faith, Abraham's trust. And this in light of the barrenness of Sarah's womb. Faith is then, according to Paul in Romans 4, reckoned to Abraham as righteousness. And of course, that's a quotation from Hebrew scriptures. And it, of course, in Romans and Galatians, Paul is working out dikaiosune, the notion of justification by faith. And here is part of the exposition to the Romans. And Paul concludes, this reckoning of righteousness to Abraham is not for Abraham's sake alone, but for ours. It will be, Paul says, reckoned to us who believe in him, who raised Jesus from the dead, who was handed over to death for our trespasses and raised for our justification. So it's a uniquely Pauline understanding of how God's promise is effectuated in the lives of those who trust and follow. I've missed Psalm 22, which is a psalm of praise. Verse 26 might be prescient. All the ends of the earth shall remember and turn to the Lord. This is a good sort of application of some Lenten ideas to a Thanksgiving and a praise psalm like Psalm 22. All right. What should we discuss?
I am struck by, this is something that we generally talk about several times, but I, in this case, would be interested in hearing both of you speak to the correlation of the readings, how they fit together. In this case, I mean, obviously the Genesis and Romans passage work together, but I wonder if there's anything to be said about the way in which the gospel reading might fit, or is it just like a tertiary element here, just keeping us on the gospel lectionary track, or is there a way that this might fit?
I had a similar kind of thought to that which you expressed as a tertiary level, where this seemed, Mark 8 seems like, just there in the lectionary context, seemed like a superstructural portion of an edifice, where Abraham, his faith was that he left Ur and undertook a really significant journey, not only a geographical journey, but a familial journey as well, in pursuit of under the promise that he had received. So this might, I'm not sure that this isn't sort of trivializing, but there's a way in which to undertake such a journey is courageous and faithful, because it has its travails, it has its turbulence, it's filled with jeopardy, and it's high risk. I don't want to simplistically equate that with suffering, but he's certainly gotten out of his comfort zone. So if Mark 8:31 to 38, one way of thinking about that third level or that superstructural addition is that it amplifies what the faith is all about, and connecting it to purposefulness in life, so that you're losing your life, not just because life is tough and hard, but you're undertaking something purposeful, which is the sake of the gospel.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it needs some beams to hold it up. If it were a house, it would need some beams to hold up that third level. But the third level just functions, it seems to me, like an amplification of aspects of what happened with Abraham and God's work with Abraham. And it may not be as far a leap from Romans 4 to Mark 8 as it is from the Genesis passage to Mark 8.
Right. Yeah, I think that your thoughts on this in Genesis are really helpful. There's a sense in which whatever it means to follow Jesus to the cross is analogous to the path that Abraham is walking here and confronted with this problem or this situation. You're going to have a child. Okay, yeah, right. Now, if you want to find the kingdom of God, you have to go and be nailed to a cross, right? That kind of thing. Righteousness, and then in Romans, a righteousness of faith, right?
Yeah. And I wonder if Mark also doesn't complexify it by giving it a twist, because the promise, as we know it, to Abraham is that he's going to be the ancestor of a multitude of nations. He will be exceedingly fruitful, and you know that's repeated. I will make nations of you, and kings shall come from you. That's exceedingly powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a hefty vision that will take generations to be realized. But even while there might be that connection of undertaking the journey, the rationale that Jesus offers is, what would it profit to gain the whole world and forfeit your life?
Mm-hmm.
So there is a bit of a contrast there, which I think has to be contextualized in the first century, for it to not be, and it would be okay if it were, to not be a complete contradiction
mm-hmm.
of what happened, of the promise to Abraham.
Right.
Well, what do you make of the eschatological ending?
Yeah, good question. I mean, you could say it's a promise held out in the central teaching of Mark's gospel, which is the cross as shame, and honor and shame being core values of the world of Jesus and Paul and the Second Temple period. So the ignominy, the dishonor of the cross is set in contrast with the return of the child of humanity, the Son of Man, in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. But that would be, that would be, in Mark 9:1, very shortly after this passage, we see a temporal indication that those who are standing here will not taste death until they see the Son of Man come with power. So it's if we put 9:1 into this context, Althea, if we're thinking about the ending of the gospel, then we could say that actually, it wasn't some future non-specific indication, but it was within one generation that Jesus speaks of the return of the Son of Man. That concludes this particular passage. It could be held out as some kind of celestial support without trivializing it too much.
For Jesus's message here, and so the is it possible then to think, to continue the idea of third level or superstructure, that actually going to 9:1 illuminates the possibility that I'm trying to say this with some precision, but it's failing me. That in a sense, could we say that the not forfeiting your life, foregoing the whole world for the sake of the kingdom of God is actually a kind of fulfillment of the promise made to Abraham in the context of the lectionary readings? Could this be the capstone of the promise made to Abraham, that the Jesus followers will be undertaking the journey with Jesus for the sake of the gospel, and by the time we get to 9:1, you know, it's a kingdom of God that will come with Paul.
Yeah, we could say that. We could say that. Yeah, I must say that it's articulated more specifically by a gospel writer like Matthew, who says the promises of God will pass to a nation yet unborn, or a nation ready to receive them. you just see Matthew has this conceptualization of the continuation of promises, but the specific group of people, the nation of people who will realize those promises may not be ones we know.
Yeah, whereas in Mark, there's more immediacy.
Yeah.
9:1.
Yeah, yeah. And any future rests with the future Son of Man, Child of Humanity, with the future actions of God, who in Mark will effectuate resurrection after the conclusion of the gospel. So Mark demands, you know, a great deal more when it comes to pistis, faith and trust, than other gospel writers do in this regard. But I was going to follow your good example and try to also look beyond Genesis 17. I mean, we have seen last week when we were discussing Lent 1, the promises to Hagar and the child Ishmael and the promises that Ishmael represents. And what we're going to see in Genesis 18 is how the promises to Abraham and Sarah for their child, Isaac. And in order for that to be realized, Abraham, who is hanging out in Genesis 18 by the oaks of Mamre, will entertain three complete strangers in the hospitality that has come to be a hallmark of most things for which Abraham stands. I was reading the other day the Testament of Abraham, which is a Greek text, perhaps first century before the Common Era. I think that's what we say when we don't know when to assign any text to, if it's a followers of Jesus text, we say sometime in the first century. So Testament of Abraham, Greek text, it opens with the description of Abraham as the person of hospitality who pitches a tent in the middle of a crossroads so that nobody going across the crossroads, which is a major crossroads in Israel, nobody going across the crossroads, east to west, north to south, will be able to pass by the hospitality of Abraham. So what Abraham in Genesis does is entertain three complete strangers who are passing by. And these strangers become, after they have been entertained and fed and conversed with Abraham about where Sarah, his wife, is, and she's listening at the tent entrance, these three strangers become the means of articulating the promise to Sarah, the promise that in her old age, as her husband is old, that she will have a son. And so maybe extending Mark 8 to chapter 9, Genesis 17 to chapter 18 would be a way to show in which way Abraham or in which way Mark envisages how to live out the faithfulness in the promises of God. What do you think?
I actually think that could be very helpful contextualization of the passages. And as you spoke, Deirdre, I felt caught in the net of the word faith. So if I might just jump off on that for a moment, to think about its connected function. Does it bring us, I think it can bring us also closer to connecting Abraham to Mark. Mm. I'm hoping it's similar to the way you were just describing it or discussing it. I'm not altogether sure. But to walk the way of Christ, to follow Jesus, to take up your cross and follow him, requires some pistis in it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what to make of it, though.
I have had some interest lately in discussions around, which I have not done too much looking into just yet, but discussions around like the word group in Greek that refers to pistis and what it's associated with. And one of the examples that I encountered this is in extra biblical contexts, right? In the ancient world, there's the example of the Odysseus's men who were taken captive by Polyphemus, the Cyclops, and they're in this cave, and and Polyphemus is trying to extract information from them about Odysseus and his location and all of these things. And the those men never give Odysseus up. And they also remain convinced or committed to the idea that Odysseus will ultimately figure out a way to save them from this situation. Mm. And it was in the ancient world used as the epitome of pistapparently, according to what I had read. And I thought this was really illuminating. and I haven't yet looked into it, but I definitely see that reflected in these two passages. That kind of thing, it's faithfulness, but not in like a God tells you to do this and you do it kind of way. It's faithfulness in the sense of like not being treacherous, not abandoning, like believing in someone or believing that it will, holding true, right? Or yep. Something like this, not. Polyphemus is torturing you trying to find out about Odysseus, but you don't give him up. And you also trust that he will be able to do this. I know another example I don't know that I remember from the Odyssey is, but I don't know if Pistis is associated with it, but I know that like when Odysseus comes back and he's got his beard and hair and everything, and nobody recognizes him anymore. But he's got this. But there was his dog was like kicked out of his palace, and his dog's been scrounging around the whole time, barely surviving. Sees him and recognizes him and runs over to him. And this is an example of virtue, right? Like a dog that has virtue, an excellent dog, but an example of faithfulness in that sense too. Remembering him and returning to him and that kind of thing. Those are the things that are resonating with me around this discussion of faith in these passages. And I wonder how it might contribute to our discussion of them, if at all.
I think we're playing with a number of things. And the an elaboration of grace, of faith rather, there's also grace in this, and I'm wondering how they fit into the notion of Abram's hospitality from the Testament of Abram that Deirdre lifted up, because it doesn't seem to me that hospitality as it's rolling through this, and I'm not thinking Deirdre suggested this, but that it's about more than giving the cup of water or washing the feet or something. I might be overstating it, but hospitality becomes then a kind of gracious inclusion that extends over centuries and is built upon generation until you get to a place like Mark, or rather Romans, really. You get to a place like that where hospitality, which then for acceptance of it requires notions of the kind of pistis that you were talking about. And I think I'd add trust, keep trust in there as a kind of confidence that the dog or the men might have had in the responsiveness of their masters. But that this hospitality actually needs these testimonies of the requirement of faith and a testimony about grace, and also a trust in the ability of this God, who at times people have had reason to wonder what that God was about. There have been tensions between them, but despite all of that, this God will come through, so to speak, and we're seeing the attestations of that God's ability to come through. So I'm sort of dumping all of that on hospitality, Deirdre.
No, I think it's love of stranger, philoxenia, is what Abraham is credited with in the whole of biblical and post-biblical tradition. I mean, this is how Abraham is conceptualized in, as I said, the Testament of Abraham. So it's not just offering of hospitality, as you said, Althea. It's not just, oh, have some water or something. It's actually philoxenia, love of stranger, real concern for their well-being, treated them kindly as guests, went the extra mile, washed their feet as well, offer them a bed, let them enter into your domain, into your household. Yes, exactly. Yeah. But I must commend Josh for drawing our attention to the Odyssey, because, you know, the Odyssey is such an, like the Iliad is such an important text for the whole of the world of Paul and the New Testament and Jesus and so on. And I mean, I suppose the dog was, I can't resist talking about the dog for 2 seconds because mm-hmm. Josh and I share a love for dogs, and I'm sure you do too, Althea. the dog had probably been kicked outside by the suitors of Penelope,
mm-hmm.
who were not at all hospitable, even if they were right. eating all of Odysseus and Penelope's food constantly right. for years right. while she resisted their entreaties, but had to put up with them in her household. So there's a sort of poignancy. Yeah,
yeah. It wasn't totally clear by that comment, but yes, and Polyphemus is an example of like failed hospitality. And,
oh yeah,
and those like hospitality was in the background of that, and that's exactly right.
Yeah,
the whole point of the suitors is how terrible they are.
Yes,
because they lack hospitality, and but even this dog, right? But this dog can demonstrate virtue. Right, and in a sense, exercise pistis, which is interesting to
yes.
consider.
Yes, I love that. I must look that passage up because I should know about dogs in antiquity as well. That's a great passage. Thank you.
And you know, just to add one more wrench or twist, not a wrench, a twist in how we're narrating this. Going back, say, to chapter 16 in Genesis. And forward also to 21, there are aspects of Abram's behavior that are not, in our terms today, not wonderful.
Yep. Not good. Yep. Absolutely.
Seriously mm-hmm. problematic.
Yes.
And I'm naming it not to judge or condemn him, but to sort of indicate the expanse of grace, the expanse of hospitality, the expanse of inclusion that on the biography of someone who is so problematic in so many ways at so many points and yet ethically heroic at other points, this mixed bag human being rests the promise.
Yeah, right.
You know, that hospitality, that grace does not preclude him. No, do I want it to include Polyphemus, Cyclops? Maybe not, but that's not my call in the face of a deity who rests a promise upon an incredibly fallible human being.
Right.
And not for the last time either.
Yep. I mean, the same could be said of the disciples to a more insignificant degree, because they're people picked from the edges of life in Galilee. They're not core people. They're not in royal households. They don't have nobility and so on. So yes, that promises of God, that the invitation to become disciples by Jesus from Mark 1 onwards should rest on these sort of unlikely characters, points to the way in which God works with unpromising material.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a source of encouragement.
Gives some of us a lot of hope. And that's true, I think, throughout Mark 8.
Yeah.
You know, it's the crowds, the anonymous crowds that I think it would be erroneous to populate with nobility only, who are there. And just to be clear, he does in 27 go on with his disciples.
Yep.
But and they're the ones who get the teaching. But in 34, he calls the crowd with his disciples, and it's to the crowd with his disciples that he says, if anyone wants to become my followers, let them deny themselves. So if the notion of hospitality, and I think it is certainly pertinent here, and if grace and faith and the courage and the trust are in this place, then the crowd, that one can never be assured and ought not to be assured, actually we should be assured of the opposite, that the crowd has questionable characters in it,
mm-hmm.
who are present with Jesus. And the disciples and the crowd make for a group that defy noble imaginings, noble constructions of its constitution.
Mm-hmm.
We have to remember that the followers of Jesus are found in Mark's gospel outside the group of disciples. As you're rightly pointing out, amongst the crowd could be followers that don't emerge individually or do emerge individually. I mean, think about the woman in Mark 14 who anoints Jesus for burial. You know, she anoints my body for death. She has understood something that the disciples hear in Mark 8, namely that to be identified as a follower of Jesus, to be the child of humanity, is to take up the cross into a situation of death. The woman in chapter 14 understands that she is anointing Jesus' body for death and burial, where the disciples here in Mark 8 do not, 8, 9, and 10. So how did she get her understanding? How did Joseph of Arimathea decide to, I mean, how do we get these, the Syrophoenician woman in chapter 7, who appears out of the blue in a different part of the country altogether, how do these people, did they hear somehow by some way from some group of people in the crowd? Or did they just come to their own assessment, having stayed on the periphery? We should make room for them too.
Yes, yes, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I like that note, Deirdre. And if I might usurp your role, I think that's a great note to end on. to make room for the crowd, to make room for those who are in the crowd who might oddly rise to notice at an opportune moment, a meaningful moment.
Right. Thank you very much. We'll look forward to our next conversation on Lent 3, when we all try to be equally as expansive and helpful. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good week. Bye-bye.